We have been listening to a presentation by Jeanette Westbrook about prosecuting perpetrators of ritual and sexual abuse. In addition to Jeanette's abilities as a social worker, she is also a singer and musician, and we're going to bring you a song entitled Holocaust, recorded by Jeanette, that she dedicates to all survivors of cult ritual abuse, mind control, and child abuse. Right after that, we will bring you an interview I conducted with Jeanette Westbrook.
Like a lifetime of dying. When the moon is full, there is darkness all around. Hands go up, with their lives they will be bound. And the souls of men, they are nowhere to be found. In a holocaust, it happens on your street. Holocaust. The victims you will meet of a holocaust. Can't you count the cost? There's a price to pay. You'll pay it one day. A lifetime of trying. Of the children who only want to live. The blood of life is all they have to give, and their sacrifice will not give them what they need. It will not squelch their hunger and their greed for all the cost. On your street, holocaust. The victims you will meet of a holocaust. Can't you count the cost? There's a price to pay. You'll pay it one day. Can't you count the cost? there's a price to pay, you'll pay it one day. There's a price to pay, we'll pay it one day. Holocaust, Holocaust, there's a price to pay, Holocaust, there's a price to pay.
Off by asking you, how was the process initially that you started remembering your abuse, and how much time had passed since the abuse ended?
Well, my last hands-on abuse by my main perpetrator, my father, the last incident of abuse occurred when I was 24 years old. So ongoing from early childhood all the way till I was 24. The process of remembering is the old off again, on again process of remembering, but only remembering certain incidences or having flashes, like viewing a faraway video that sometimes became clear and sometimes was fog covered. I really started getting a lot of my memories and flashbacks at age 28 when I met and married my husband.
Was there certain things that triggered flashbacks for you, or did they come? How did they come?
Well, I have an idea about how that happens. I think, for me, that when I married my husband, I was then in a routine day-to-day relationship with someone, and an ongoing, regular sexual relationship with someone, my husband. And what prompted me to enter therapy was shortly after I got married, I was sitting on the bed in our bedroom, and my husband sat down beside me, and he simply placed his hand on my leg, on my knee. And I had a flashback, and I started breaking things. I was just rageful. And it was almost like I blacked out when I did this, or what I know now to be a switch. And after this, I thought, oh my God, what is going on? I have to do something. Little did I know, there were parts of me that throughout the years had gone to other therapists trying to get help without my knowledge.
So this, you had gone to therapy for other things that were happening in your life before the age of 28 then?
Yes, but I did not know they were going to a therapist and talking about incest. They actually had approached therapists. And most of the time, from what I now understand, is that most therapists at the time, in the early 80s and prior to that, even in the 70s, they weren't dealing with issues of incest, period.
I suspect that you had dissociative identity disorder. At what stage was this?
Well, after I started having some flashbacks, I really started getting a memory of, as a child, being ostracized and isolated in school because I had failed the first grade, repeated the first grade. At the end of the second grade, they tested my IQ. It was only 80 points at the time, which was a reflection, I believe, of the overwhelming trauma that I was experiencing. In the seventh grade, one of my parts, Jenny, I was walking down the hall in school, and I was sad. I was lonely. I felt alone. I felt I had no friends. And Jenny said to me, "I'll show you how to make friends. I'll do it for you." So this part, Jenny, and alter, or however you want to frame that, was so outgoing and talented and could sing, could do so many things that I felt at the time that I could not do. She was winning friends all over the school. So we had a social life. So this part of me lived many years of my life for me, or had most of the time, or lived a lot of my life for me, so that I wouldn't be lonely and ostracized, so that I would have a social life, so I could gain some social skills.
Can you talk about what age you think your abuse started by your father, and what kind of things happened?
There were various types of abuse, but as a young child, I didn't have enough food to eat. That was a result of plain old neglect. It was not because there wasn't enough money to provide food. It was because of neglect. The abuse, the different types of abuse, one vivid memory that I had, that I've also drawn pictures of, that I also reported to my police detective in the course of prosecuting my father. I was hung upside down with ropes from rafters in the garage. It was an unattached garage beside our house. I still have the scars on my ankles from this. I was threatened with a welding rod. I was penetrated with an object upside down. Other types of abuse would be simply just being in bed, taken from my home, taken out of bed, raped. It could be any time of the night. It could be with people I knew or did not know.
Now, when you say ritual abuse, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by ritual abuse is severe physical, mental, spiritual abuse at the hands of multiple perpetrators. I mean abuse that is taken in the context of not only a spiritual or religious belief, but abuse that is very hard to define as why, which all victims ask ultimately, why. It is abuse that is torturous. It involves torture. It involves threats of torture. It involves threats to your person, to your very being of your soul. It involves threats to humanity. It involves threats to persons that you hold dear. It involves threats to your pets. It involves
And through these threats, did you feel that you couldn't escape the situation? You couldn't just run away from it?
Well, yes, I felt that way. And to explain how my childhood was, we were over-controlled when we were very young. And as we became teenagers, there was no control. We were running the streets. We were everywhere. Promiscuous, drug using. The house was loaded with drugs. There was no need to go out in the street to find drugs. It was right there. It was a proverbial drugstore.
Was it your father that was bringing the drugs in, or?
As I was aware, my father assisted someone in my family with what I considered drug dealing, but in my opinion, it was not this other person that was responsible, but ultimately my father who was responsible for this.
Do you have any indication, or some of these other perpetrators that were outside of your family, what was the relationship to your father?
Some were known to him through his fraternal organization. Some were known to him through his religious organization, which I definitely feel he never belonged to the religious organization. It was simply a way to procure more victims. I was not his only victim. I was not his only victim in our family. He had multiple victims outside of our family. When I revealed to one of my father's relatives, his only remaining direct relative, this relative revealed to me that she had been raped by two of the same family members that had raped me as a child. I was able to document at least three generations. The police also had photographs and access to the site where I was taken as a child in the context of ritual abuse. The evidence existed. Not only did my main detective investigate and believe me, I had other police officers that supported me, that accompanied me to approach the district attorney.
Did you feel that specifically the Masonic context had anything to do with the ritual itself? Was there Masonic elements to the rituals, ritual abuse?
I don't necessarily feel that there was. I feel that birds of a feather flock together. I feel that his cohorts in his fraternal organization, as part of their joining in an abuse of me, were because they were all pedophiles, simply pedophiles, regardless if they were practicing Satanists, regardless if they were a member of a fraternal organization, regardless if they were a Boy Scout leader, regardless if they were a community figure, regardless if they worked for state government, regardless if they worked for federal government. What is indicative to me underneath all of this is the fact that these are persons that commit crimes against children of the most hideous nature, crimes that are sadistically violent. I think that he and others attempted not only to sadistically abuse me, but to split my mind, into as many pieces, to split my personality. As a matter of fact, my sister remembered my father calling me by other names. She wondered, why was she being called by these other names? He definitely knew of my alter personalities.
Do you think he had, I mean, this sounds a lot like the deliberate creation of multiple personalities with the mind control, government-funded mind control experiments. Did you feel that your father had knowledge of these kind of techniques, or he just picked up somehow that you did have multiple personalities and then continued to use that against you?
I have not completed all of my research, especially concerning his military career and any connections there. From what I know now, I would find it very remote that he would have known this on his own, the capacity to induce this. However, I do believe that, not only do I believe, I know that organizations, whether we want to call them Satanist or whether we want to call them organized pedophile clubs, whether we want to call them mind control, are very much aware of multiple personality defense systems. They definitely know about it, and they seek to create it as a way to keep their abuse of the victim hidden. They use this in a manner that protects their identity. So as I and all parts of me being abused, horrible sadistic abuse, could get up in the morning and go to school and function and come home and live with these perpetrators.
Did your father threaten you, just outright threaten you if you told anybody?
Absolutely, yes. He threatened me, not only verbally, but he threatened me with a welding rod. A welding rod is an item that's hot enough to melt metal.
Specifically choose to leave out the ritual aspects of the abuse in the court, or did you somehow want to work that in?
Definitely left it out. Because there were no statutes against ritual abuse, it was clear that the courts would not proceed under a statute that did not exist. First-degree rape, whether in the context of ritual or organized abuse, rape is rape is rape. That's a crime. Used in force, it was a felony crime. Used by your first-degree relative, it is incest.
How do you think, if you did introduce testimony regarding the ritual abuse aspects, how do you think that would have been received by the court and the jury?
I think it would have been very difficult, if not impossible. However, the players behind the scenes, that is, the district attorney, the police officers involved in my case, my own personal attorney, including persons in the Kentucky Attorney General's office, everyone knew it was a ritual abuse case. People were very much sure of the case, and this is what it was, because of the really vast amount of collaborative and not only collaborative but evidence that I had, and also supporting testimony from other victims.
While you were gathering evidence for your case, did you feel you were hampered or sabotaged in any way by your perpetrators?
Not only did I feel that I was sabotaged, I felt that the entire criminal justice system not only erected barriers in front of me to the criminal justice system, but in essence stuck their foot out and tripped me several times, each time getting up and moving over those barriers, and using every advocacy organization that I could contact. I had letters of support from other victims that were behind me in my call to go through the criminal justice system to bring this perpetrator to justice. I did not seek a criminal recourse against my perpetrator until I got the knowledge that my perpetrator had not only raped me, but had raped other victims. I could not stand up for myself, but I found the courage to stand up for others through the system. Absolutely, there was sabotage, not only within this system. My father was very much connected with the system that existed in the jurisdiction in which I brought charges. As a matter of fact, the DA refused to bring charges, even in the face of massive evidence, even in the face of my police detective tape recording my sibling confronting my perpetrator over the telephone, getting this information on tape, even in the face of that, and even in the face of taped admissions, refusing to go forward with the case, to the point where I involved the Attorney General's office, the Victims Advocacy Division, and they sent a contingent to the local DA insisting that my case be released or insisting that they prosecute my case. The DA still refused to prosecute the case, and then the Attorney General's office interceded and moved to take jurisdiction of the case and then moved to extradite my perpetrator, who was now living in another state, and extraditing my perpetrator back to the state of Kentucky to stand trial on felony first degree rape.
So at that point, upon the point of extradition, the trial was ready to go forward at that point?
Yes, it was.
And could you talk about what happened at this point?
Well,
what happened next?
Yeah, the Attorney General's office went forward with the process of extradition and drawing up the extradition papers, ready to extradite him. My perpetrator happened to be out of the United States in another country, meeting with presidents and dignitaries of foreign countries. Upon his return to the United States, he came home on a Thursday night. Friday night, from what I understand, he fixed steak dinners and barbecued out. By Sunday, he was dead. He died at home. The reason given was that supposedly he died of a heart attack at age 64. It was signed off by a private physician. There is no autopsy done, which is very unusual given the person is being charged with felony indictments and being extradited back to another state, which is fairly rare.
Did your father have a history of heart problems or any health problems before that?
From what I understand, he was fairly healthy, although there had been other deaths in his family of heart attacks, and I might add deaths by other family members that were perpetrators.
And when your father was visiting the foreign countries, this was with the business of the nuclear power station, his work?
Yes, it was connected with the nuclear industry. That is, what he was doing in those countries was formulating programs for these countries that were now not under the communist system that depended heavily on nuclear power for industry, for heating their homes, etc. And he was there helping them develop new nuclear power systems, from what I understand, especially in the area of nuclear safety, which the communist regimes were sorely lacking in safety precautions concerning the use of domestic nuclear energy.
Not only in the communist. You've been listening to an interview with Jeanette Westbrook, a social worker, singer, and survivor of ritual and sexual abuse by her father and others. As we've heard, her father was the executive director for the organization responsible for inspecting all nuclear power plants in the U.S. He was a Grandmaster Mason, Boy Scout leader, and church deacon. Jeanette's legal case against her father, if it had gone forward, would have created a scandal. Just before having to face charges in court, Jeanette's father had died. This has been show number 22 in the ongoing radio series on mind control. Tune in next week for an interview with Dr. Stephen Kent about cult ritual abuse. You've been listening to CKLN 88.1.